Welcome to another exciting episode of Why Your Story, brought to you from the beautiful home of SVI Media. I am your host, Travis Osmond.
And I am your host, Mary Jo Parker.
And together we are
Why Your Story. And the crowd screams.
Yay! Anyway, everyone, we're excited to be back with you today for another great episode of Why Your Story. MJ, how you feeling?
I'm feeling great. How are you feeling?
Good. You've had a little ordeal in your life
last week
or two.
But that's okay.
But you're getting over it.
I am. Getting ready for another one.
Wow. Good old knee surgeries.
Ugh.
You gotta love them.
Mm-mm.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
But you're doing great. You're running around. You're catching frisbees now. You're doing good.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Oh, this is awesome. So we are excited today for our podcast.
We are.
Aren't we, though?
Excited. Yes. We've tried this before, and this time it's going to worketh.
It is going to work, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we have tried several times in the past to get this guest on, and I think it's going to happen today. So we're just going to delve right into it. But first of all, I got to tell you about my new favorite drink.
What is your new favorite drink? What is it?
The Pina Colada.
The Pina Colada.
Pina Colada from the pop shop in Afton. I kind of go through these things where I'm like, okay, I'm feeling like a working dad. Okay, I'm feeling like a let them eat cake, or I'm feeling like a peaches and cream.
Mm-hmm.
But today it's the Pina Colada.
Nummy.
Oh, it's so good.
Ooh. Oh,
so
I'll
good.
Try that.
With a chocolate chip cookie.
Oh, of course.
Hard to beat.
Hard to beat. That's
so,
for sure.
Thanks, Pop Shop, for sponsoring us.
I know. You know, we decided we were going to do some different errors. Eras. And so we did the 60s, the 70s, and we both at the same time, we both said, Huey Lewis in the News.
Our favorite bands.
Yeah,
in the 80s. Our favorite bands in the 80s.
I mean, there's some really great ones for sure. Yeah. But anyway, we found this person who just happens to play for them, or did. And so let's give him a call.
But we got to preface this.
Okay.
I mean, this is the main guy.
Right.
So you think about Huey Lewis in the News. Heart of Rock and Roll.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the Future.
Yep.
I mean, the greatest songs of all times.
Right.
Are in that era.
They were iconic. They were just good. It was good music.
See if I can go way back. I Want a New Drug.
Yes, you do.
Right? No, I'm talking about Huey Lewis songs. So, I Want a New Drug, okay, mm-hmm. was one. The Heart of Rock and Roll.
Yep.
Was one of my favorite ones growing up, for darn sure. What about The Power of Love?
Power of Love. Wow.
How about
Heart and Soul?
Oh, yeah. The Heart and Soul. What's I'm trying to do? Do you believe in love? All of those. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, it's Huey Lewis.
That's right.
And so this guy that we're going to talk to right now, Mario,
mm-hmm.
was his bass player.
That's right. Just really one of the best bass players around.
And so we are just excited. So should we call him and see
yeah.
if he'll answer?
Yeah, let's call him and see if he'll answer.
So we're calling somewhere in California.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't say where.
No.
I will say the county is Marin.
I don't even know where that is.
It's a nice area.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here we go. I'm going to let you say hi first.
I'm kind of giddy.
Hello.
Hi, Mario. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am good. This is Mary Jo. It's so good to talk to you again.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you too. We're not on the air now, right?
We are. We're on the air.
We are. Good. Well, that's exciting.
Mario, this is MJ's friend Travis. I'm also on the air with you.
So Travis,
hi Travis, great. It's great to hear from you. So let's cook it, guys.
Mario, this is so cool that we get to talk to you today. We've tried a couple times to grab you, and our schedules haven't been able to align yet, but
yeah,
we're actually talking to the bass player for Huey Lewis in the News.
Yeah.
We are?
We are.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was all excited for a second.
Okay.
Well, you should be, because I think you know the guy pretty well.
Yeah.
He's Jack.
Yeah, I think so too.
He's a bit of a problem.
So, what can I do for you guys? What do you want to talk about?
So how we started on this journey to talk to you today is we did this podcast every couple of weeks, and we broke down our favorite bands from the 60s, and then we broke down our favorite bands from the 70s, and then we were in the middle of talking about our favorite bands from the 80s, and both of us at the same time said Huey Lewis in the News, and then MJ says, "Hey, I know a guy," and so we're like, "Well, let's talk to that guy." So anyway, we just are so appreciative of you coming and talking to us today, and we have a bunch of questions that we'd like to ask you.
No problem.
Thank you so much.
Happy to make up something exciting for you.
And Travis grew up in the music world, so his dad is Merrill Osmond, and I think you met Mario once when you were little, right?
His dad is who?
Merrill Osmond, one of the Osmond brothers.
That's, oh, yeah.
Like 10 years before your time there, but it's still the same era and both bass players. And so I grew up traveling the world in a tour bus, so I know a little bit about what that life's like. But
right. Yeah.
It's always nice to hear other people's perspectives. So having that perspective, I have some questions that I'm excited to ask you.
Okay.
To do that, but I think MJ, why don't you go ahead and lead out if you want, and then I'll just kind of.
How are you feeling about Mary Jo? Are you feeling all right?
Oh yeah, I feel good.
You're okay. You're welcome.
Yeah.
Concerned about you.
Oh, thank you.
We both have. Mm-hmm. We both have. She's been kind of down and out lately, so we're
I know.
We're glad she's doing well.
That's okay.
Great.
That's okay.
But you hear that, everybody? Mary Jo was not feeling well, and now she's feeling better.
Thank you. So when did you get started? Like, when did you kind of know, hey, I wanna play a guitar. I wanna do something different.
Well, I started playing bass when I was six. They offered it in school. My first grade, you could sign up for anything you want, music lessons, and the way they did is they had symphony players come to the school, and they had a mimeograph sheet, you know, a piece of paper that smells so good that mimeograph stuff.
Yeah.
And so they had one of those for everybody, and it had a drawing, this little picture of each of the instruments that they were offering. And so they played out the violin, the saxophone, this, that, and the guy came up with a string bass, and it was huge, and I liked that. and then when he pulled the bow across the string, it just had this, it vibrated everything in the room, you know. And I just thought that was great. So I signed up for bass and started playing right away. And as far as when I knew something was happening, well, let's see. I'm trying to think. I started playing electric when I was about 12. And I would say in the first year of playing, I did a few, you know, high school dances and stuff. And I just loved it more than anything. It was all I, from then on, it's all I thought about.
Oh, wow.
And so when I was 15 years old, I was a sophomore in high school, my first beginning of the year, and I had a friend of mine in school whose father was Tom Donahue, who Tom started Underground Radio. He's the father, they call him the father of FM radio. And I went to school with his kids, and so he knew me, and I knew him. And he was managing a band called Stoneground that had just had a record come out, and their bass player took a leave of absence, and they needed a bass player, and so they asked me to play, which is, in hindsight, it's pretty interesting that he would ask a friend of his kids from school to play. These guys were all, you know, 20 years older than me.
Wow.
And it was a very professional thing, you know. And but he knew I was a pretty good player. He'd heard demos of my bands and stuff, and so he asked me if I would sit in for, he thought it was going to be for 2 weeks, but the guy went to England to cut Gasoline Alley with Rod Stewart, and he never came back.
Oh my goodness! Oh,
wow.
So I had that gig for about a year, and my first date with the band was at the Hollywood Bowl. So I left high school. I had a note from home to leave early, and I got I left at 10 o'clock in the morning. Up to there was outside. There's a Cadillac limousine waiting for me out in front of the school. And I got in and drove away in the limousine, and I remember looking back at the clock tower, thinking, "I'm just not going to see much of you anymore." I don't think, and I really did. But that was it. That was, you know, by the time I was 15, I was you know, working professionally, and wow. And it was pretty clear to me what I was going to be doing.
Mario, what do you attribute that to? Do you attribute that to hard work? Do you feel like you had a knack for picking up bass and feeling the bass? Do you attribute that to the being around the right people? I mean, what do you attribute that to?
What do I attribute what to?
Your success at an early age, getting to where you're at.
I had a knack for it. I was definitely not a hard worker. Never have been. So I'll admit to you privately here now that I was a lazy bum when it comes to doing anything, but I love the bass. So it's not that I was lazy. It's just, it was easy because I loved it. So it was I worked all the time at it, but I loved it. So it wasn't work. And plus my brother was a successful musician at that point already. Had been for a while. He was in the Quicksilver Messenger Service. Oh, yeah. And so my name was known. It was helpful in getting exposed to work, but it didn't help me staying in work. You know, I had to be good enough to, I had to be good enough to pull it off, you know?
Yeah,
for sure. And I also had to be smart enough to shut my mouth because I was a little kid. So I realized I was working with people that were much more mature than me, much more experienced than me, and so I knew well enough to keep my mouth shut and not, you know, say all the stupid crap that was going on in my mind, you know? Because I was a 15-year-old kid, so I had all these dumb things in my head. What do you think about this? What do you think about that? But I for some reason, I was smart enough to keep my mouth shut and just do the work and keep stepping on toes until I got where I wanted to be.
and so in that getting to where you wanted to be, how did you go from being a 16-year-old kid in that, you know, asked to sit in now and you've got a gig? How did that go to now being one of the best bands in the world with Huey Lewis? How did that happen?
Well, kind of a funny, just the circumstances really. I had a band in high school when I was playing with Songground. I had my own band in my school chums, and we played every day. Every day I was working with the Songground guys. I was rehearsing with my band, and we played a lot of, you know, homegrown shows. And there's another band that went from my high school that was called Clover. And in that band was Sean Hopper, the keyboard player for the News, and Huey. They were in Clover. And my band, Soundhole, we had Johnny and Bill and I, who ended up in the News. So we were two competing, kind of rival high school bands that, it wasn't a real big rivalry. I mean, I think the extent of it was, when we would do shows together, which we did a lot because there weren't a lot of places to play, so a lot of times we ended up playing at the same nightclub, and we had poster wars. Like the Clover guys would make a poster for the show that we were doing together. They had Clover in great big letters, and Soundhole in little tiny letters, and we would make a poster for the same show with Soundhole in great big letters and Clover in little tiny letters, and then we would go around for the week or two before the show and put posters up over each other's posters.
Oh, oh boy!
So that was a rivalry, you know. Each of us was trying to make ourselves look bigger than the other guy. And then later on, after years of trying to get a record deal and make something happen, nothing did happen. So we ended up dissolving the two bands roughly around the same time in 77. And in 78, I was asked to play with Tony Williams, who was the drummer. You probably heard of him. He's a jazz drummer.
You bet.
Yeah. So I played with Tony Williams for the better part of that year, and played with Montrose at that year, same year. And then I got an audition with the Foreigner. Their bass player quit. So I got an audition with Foreigner and went to New York. And I got the job out of 200 people auditioned for the gig, and I got it.
No kidding!
And,
wow.
Yeah, and that was when they were really huge. They were absolutely the biggest band going at that time.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, you know, Hot Blooded and all that stuff.
Oh yeah.
And believe it or not, I actually got the job playing bass and singing all the high harmonies.
Oh wow!
Which I don't have. I don't consider myself a singer at all, but I can sing backup vocals, but I don't know how I did it. I don't really know how I pulled that off, but I was doing all the high harmonies. I worked really hard to get it where I could do that. And then, so I was in New York and I got a call from Huey, who said, "Hey, look, we got a possible, opportunity here." He says, "Patty Gleason, the owner of the studio where we cut the we had cut a demo." Huey had he got a record deal with Polygram for one record, a single.
Okay.
And they hired him to put a band together and for to make a version, believe it or not, a disco version of Exodus.
Oh.
I don't know why.
Wow.
And I know. I don't know why. I don't know how, what the hell that was all about. But yeah, we did a disco version of Exodus.
Wow.
And we had some money left over. We had a $6,000 budget, but we spent $1,000 cutting the songs. So we cut a bunch of our own songs for the fun of it. And then this is before I went to the Foreigner audition. And so we did this thing for fun. We just wanted to hear our songs and get together. We hadn't seen each other in a long time. And so anyway, I ended up in New York. We forgot all about the tape we'd made. And Huey called and said Patty Gleason, the owner of the studio, his wife had given our tape of the demo of our stuff to this guy Bob Brown. He said he's a manager. He manages Pablo Cruz, and he really loves it. He loves the band, and he wants to manage us. And what do you think? And I said, "Well, shit, I just got this gig. You know, let me call you back. Let me think about it." And I kind of added things up, and you know, I honestly felt like a fish out of water up there in New York. I mean, yeah, I was a Mill Valley kid who got this job, and I was making $6,000 a week.
Wow.
And I was living in New York, and let's just say I had a penchant for having a good time.
Sure, sure.
And it was pretty clear to me that there's a real good possibility of me dying in a hotel room or something terrible, you know, if I kept it up the way I was going. So I told the four guys, "Thank you very much. No, thank you." And came back home and we started the band.
Wow.
That's amazing. How we started it.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
As far as the success goes, I think a lot of our success came from the fact that, we got a lot of airplay on MTV. MTV was starting the same year we started our band. And, they didn't have a lot of content because they were a new station. It was kind of an experiment that they were doing.
Right.
And they didn't have any content. You know, they just took what they could get. And we gave them a lot of videos. You know, we would cut our videos locally with, you know, we'd hire the San Francisco State film crew, you know, movie class, you know, to shoot our video for $500.
Oh,
and
wow.
We shoot all these videos. We should probably, I don't know if you've seen them, the early
absolutely
videos are all just just us jumping around the beach and just so
yeah. Oh yeah.
And jumping around different places and
like haunted mansions and stuff like that.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah. The earlier videos, the haunted mansions were pretty fancy, but the earliest yeah. ones were pretty low budget, but they played them, and so people thought we were successful because we were on MTV. We didn't have any record sales for the first two albums came and went with no sales and not a lot of airplay either, but we were getting airplay on MTV, and so I really attribute a large part of our success to Bob Brown, who was a fantastic manager, right. And a great guy. And be MTV, you know, that was huge for us. So
that's you know, it was awesome.
And I will say we were a really good band. We were really back then. We were playing like our lives depended on it, you know, and which they kind of were.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So there you go. That's a long answer to a short question.
Oh, that is so cool.
That's really cool. Yeah. So what? Out of all of your songs that you've sang or done, what one is like closest to your heart?
So a Little Kindness, which you've never, it's not the one. There's one that the band recorded after I left.
Okay.
Called So a Little Kindness, but it's not that one. There's a song that we tracked, never released, and it's by far I think is the best song we ever did.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And I kicked and screamed and couldn't get the band to release it. They wouldn't put it out.
No kidding.
Yep. I think it's our best song we ever did. Hmm. They at that time were trying to be a little more maybe politically correct or something like that. And the line in the song says, "So little kindness, people of all God's children are sent from up above." It's an innocent line. You know, mm-hmm. it's nothing Catholic or even God fearing about it. It's just a little line. The band dug their heels in and said, "Nope, we're not gonna release it."
Wow!
And I'll bet you anything, if I sent it to you, you'd say the same thing. I bet you'd say it was the best song we ever did.
Wow!
Yeah,
that's fascinating. I'll send it to you guys.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, that'd be great.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. I'll send it to you.
Okay.
So I just email. I don't know if I have your email address, but I'll get it from you and I'll send it to you.
Okay.
I would do it right now, but I don't have it.
Fantastic.
Yeah. That's
after
awesome.
we'll get you MJ's email address and send it to her.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll send it today. Sure.
So awesome. Over the years, Mario, a question that I have. I mean, everybody wants to know what kind of equipment that one musician kind of relates to or feels mm-hmm. strongly about. What's been your over the years, what brand or feel or what that Mario likes the best?
Hmm. That's a really hard question. I have so much gear. I've always been. I'm a tone seeker.
Love it. Yes,
I am a really hardcore tone seeker. I'm always looking. How can I get the best sound or a better sound? So I've been a seeker, you know, and so I have a lot of things. I will say that, I guess that now that I think of it, that the one piece of gear that I always come back to is Gallian Kruger.
Yes.
As far as amps goes, amplification goes, I've always come back to their stuff. It has an inherent sound that seems to match up with me well, and I've never endorsed them.
Sure.
But I use it a lot, and so I'd have to say, as far as the amps goes, I'd have to say if I was going to take one amp, it'd probably be a Gallian Kruger amp. Yeah.
What about bass? Yeah. What about guitar?
Well, my bass is that's kind of personal, but I mean, I have a lot of basses,
sure.
But I have a number one for sure, and my number one is a Yamaha. It's a bass they built for me. In about 92, I was over there and they came to our show in Tokyo and asked me if I'd like to come to their studio and develop a bass. And I said, sure. I said, but, you know, I said, kind of endorsing another product right now and stuff. And they said, well, we don't want to endorse them. We just want to make you a bass.
Oh, wow.
So I said, great. I went over to their place and I designed a bass from the ground up. I've done a lot of design work, I will say. I've done a lot of designing. I designed for PV and designed sure. for Warwick and designed for other people. But I had never worked with Yamaha. They're great to work with, and we made a bass that's just a monster, and it's nothing fancy, but it's real special. And so
that's neat.
Yeah, I did get him to do a couple of trick things, but at that point, I was all any bases I had made, I was always having them made with a painted painted fingerboard. Because, you know, they usually are not painted.
Right.
And so I was getting this into this thing where I was having the paint on the neck matching the rest of the instrument. So, which is really hard to do because they have to paint it first. Well, they have to put the frets in and then paint it and then individually scrape the paint off of the frets, which is a pain in the ass. It's really, you know, it's just some guy sitting there with an X-Acto blade, you know, trying to get it.
Yeah.
You know. So, they made a sunburst instrument for me with a sunburst that goes all the way up to the fingerboard,
which is
just amazing looking.
Gorgeous.
And it's got, LEDs in the fingerboard for where the frets are and stuff. So it's kind of a slick looking little guy, but, when I turn the lights off, it just looks like a bass, you know, the cool fingerboard.
That's so neat.
Wow. It's not a funny. It's not a funny shape or anything. It's pretty traditional looking.
Yeah.
Huh. Hey, when you were a little kid, I heard there was a pretty famous singer that offered you your first alcoholic beverage. Do you want to?
Oh yeah.
Who was that?
Well, Janis Joplin. I was hanging around with my brother's. At the Fillmore, he was there playing at the Fillmore, and I was about 11 at that time. And so I was, my sister and I, we liked going to the shows because it was an excuse we could smoke, because we could ditch my parents. They'd be stuck somewhere, you know, with all the hippies, you know, dancing around and stuff. And my sister and I would disappear and go chain smoke cigarettes. And so we were backstage wandering around, and I wandered into one of these little nook and cranny rooms that the Fillmore had, and there was Janis and a couple of bandmates. I wasn't even really sure who she was, but she offered me a drink, and I took one, and that was my first hard liquor. It was, wow, it was that's not very good tasting stuff, but I liked it. And I actually didn't know who she was until a couple of weeks later. They were playing a show with my brother's band up on Mount Tam, and I knew who they were playing, and I'd heard about them with this singer that they had who was supposed to be kind of wild, and I remember walking up to the theater and seeing them playing, and it was weird because I could hear her voice. She had such a raspy voice, but she was from the top of the theater. You couldn't see what she looked like, and it looked like a little old lady. She had like a long dress on and a big floppy hat, and I thought she was an old lady. I thought, man, she can really sing, you know.
Oh wow!
And then we got closer, and then that was how I kind of put two and two together. And I saw, got closer, and saw, I said, "That's the lady who gave me that drink."
At the
Fillmore.
That's
amazing.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. 11 years old. Yeah. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Wow. I don't know if my parents would ever agree with you, but
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So Mario, in your long career in doing this business, you've got to have a memory or two that sticks out as maybe a defining moment in your career, or a humbling moment, or something like that. Can you share one or two of those with us?
Well,
like, weren't you guys fairly new?
Getting fired is a really major memory for me, actually.
Getting fired?
Yeah.
I can imagine.
I was fired from Huey Lewis and the News. I didn't quit. I was fired.
I didn't know that.
I didn't either.
Yeah. Yeah.
And do you want to say why, or?
Well, sure. I don't mind. My mom and brother had died recently, just a year before, and I kind of fell into a pretty bad depression. And
I'm sorry.
My way of dealing with it was somebody got me strung out on heroin. Someone I knew, but I didn't know what it was. He told me it was something else. But so he got me strung out, and then you know, it just didn't take that long before I changed, you know, my whole situation changed pretty drastically.
Wow.
And, gosh.
Yeah, so.
Bless your heart.
Yeah.
Bless my heart, man. It was horrible.
Yeah.
The worst thing I've ever been through. But the worst thing was I went to treatment, and a week after being in treatment, the band came and fired me.
So I was
just trying to get well, and I got fired. And when I got fired, that's when I really bottomed out. I mean, I didn't have much to live for. I attempted suicide 3 times. That's pretty life changing because yeah. One minute I was on my way to coming back, and then I didn't have it anymore. All my best friends, my only friends, were in the band, so everything, my world is completely imploded.
Wow.
And it's taken a lot to come back. Took a lot to get sober with that in my past, you know?
Sure.
Absolutely.
One thing I want to say about you is my niece took guitar lessons from him, from Mario.
Mm-hmm.
And one of his, and his advice was, he was just like, you know, don't you do drugs, don't you drink, you know, you stay. And she did. I mean, she's a really good, Emily's a really good girl. And Mario, this is how kind he is, and has changed so much. But she painted a picture of his sister and his brother and him, and gave it to him. And he gave her the black coat you see in all of the records.
No kidding.
Mario gave that to Emily, which is her most prized possession. And she's 21 now, and she cannot tell you how great Mario is and what a great mentor. And
she's a hell of a bass player. She really came up.
She's pretty good. Yeah. But it's all because of you. It really is.
Cool. She came and sat in with my band. The band was at that time. She came and sat in with them. And she totally pulled it off.
Wow.
She never told you that?
You what?
She hasn't told you that?
No, she didn't tell me that.
She came and sat in with my band. I left the stage. Left it to her.
Oh, wow.
That is so cool.
Yeah, she did about 3 songs with the Reckless in Vegas. Yeah, she did great.
Holy smokes.
That is amazing.
No, I didn't even know that. That's how humble she is. But
yeah,
you really,
she's great.
You were a great and are a great mentor to many, many kids out there. And you're so honest and raw. And I just appreciate that so much.
You bet.
Yeah, well, she put up a lot too, though, because you know I'm bipolar aside from everything else, and I told her when we first started teaching, I said, you know, there are times when, you know, I may not be very consistent.
Yeah.
<what I said. laughs> And you know, so when I was in the tank, I would just call her up and say, I'm not here. Well, the Mario you have reached is not in service at this time.
Right. Yeah.
And so she had to put up a lot of that kind of stuff, you know. So she was pretty giving forgiving and stuff.
Yeah.
So
back to some of your playing. So in all the years I've just followed you guys and so many other bands, but there's only one bass player that I can think of in all of my history that has the most unique style of strumming the bass, and that's you.
Yeah,
you have the most unique style. The way you use your thumb, and deaden the strings. Where can you speak a little bit to that and how that came?
You noticed that, huh? That's pretty cool. I didn't know anyone really noticed.
So the
muting and stuff that's going on there.
My dad grew up in the '60s and '70s, and all he did is he loved the Fender jazz bass with a pick, and so that's how I was raised, and so.
Uh-huh.
But you've got it mastered with one finger.
Well, see, what it is, it's actually, I play with my fingers pretty traditionally with both my index and my first, my third finger. I play, that's how I prefer to play and play a lot of my parts that way. But I early on, I found that I liked the tone of the pick for a lot of different things. And a lot of times, I like the tone of the pick in the same song that I like the fingers for other stuff.
Yes.
So I started making these picks that I take a thumb pick and I cut off the pick part because it's too thick when you buy a thumb pick. The thumb parts, the pick parts is so thick it has no give to it.
Yeah.
And it feels terrible. So I started cutting off the pick part and gluing on a fender pick, a regular fender flat pick. And that works really well for me. So I have a pick that's stuck on my thumb, so I can play with my fingers and switch to the thumb pick. And that's, so when you see me doing muting and stuff, it's just usually it's because that's a part of the song or dynamically I want to get something different.
Right.
And I've never been very good at playing with a pick. So I just do downstroke, pretty much eighth notes, downstroke kind of stuff. I don't do anything very fancy with a pick, but I do like the tone, and it works well for some of that kind of early on with that new wavy kind of stuff to kind of baba 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 baba.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Fascinating. Yeah,
I'm surprised you noticed that. That's cool. I didn't know anyone just spot what I was doing with the muting, with the palm and stuff.
I picked up on that when I was like 12 years old.
Oh, cool. Great.
So you bet. I love it. Let's absolutely love it.
So
I wasn't fooling you.
That's right. Travis is pretty with it. So We Are the World, of course, is like very well known. And you guys were just fairly new when you went into that. When you went in there, were you like awestruck with who was in there? And wasn't there kind of a funny story with, I think, Bob Dylan and I can't remember who else, Stevie Wonder or something? Can you explain that experience walking in that room with all those famous?
Pretty hard to describe it. It has a real dreamlike quality to those memories, you know. Because when we did the Grammys, and then after the Grammys we were taken to A&M Records, to their studio there, and we didn't really know what to expect. We knew that Michael Jackson had done the track and stuff, and some of these people were supposed to be there. We didn't know everyone and their mother was going to be there. But so when we came in, there's an ante room before the studio, and they checked all of our associates. In other words, no one but musicians were allowed in the studio. Only the musicians.
Oh wow!
No managers, agents, girlfriends, nobody. Could not allow it. So it was just to us. So they said, "Park your manager here, your girlfriend's here, and you can go in here." And we went in there, and we opened the door, and shit, there's a Bob Dylan sitting on the floor reading a comic book. Quincy Jones is at the board conducting the whole thing. Michael Jackson walks up and introduces himself to us, and it was just, you know, Stevie Wonder, Ray Charles, the Pointer Sisters, everyone was there. It was just ridiculous.
Wow.
Cyndi Lauper, who we knew, it was good to see her, and you know, Hall & Oates, and the list is pretty crazy. And there was a funny thing. We were kind of the lead vocal. We did all the choral stuff first, and then they did the lead tracks, which I think they used about 12 of the bigger name singers, and they used Huey, which was great, and they had all these people, that were going to sing lead lines, in a circle around a microphone, and they would just sing a sentence each. They'd sing a sentence, and then the next guy would pick it up. We were trying to do it all in a row, like Stevie Wonder sing his line, and the next sentence Bob Dylan would sing his line, or whatever. So we're cutting the vocals, the lead vocals, and every time it got to Bob Dylan, the music would play, and he didn't sing anything.
Oh wow!
And so Quincy would stop the tape and say, "Oh, hey Bob, let's try that again." And go back and start the tape again. And came to his place, and there's no singing. He says, "What's going on?" So Bob says, "I don't know." You know, quietly. He says, "I'm not really sure what to sing." And he just didn't have any ideas, and so. Stevie Wonder was really cool. He said, hey, Bobby, come over here. And he took him over to the piano. He was sitting at the piano, actually. And he started playing the music, and he started singing, imitating Bob Dylan.
What?
You know, you just believe. Yeah, believe us all.
Wow.
You know, he was doing his Bob Dylan imitation, and he gave Bob the exactly what he sang. He sang exactly what Stevie did.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Know, when he was, yeah. So, there's actually a video of that on YouTube. Somebody found that clip and put it on there. You can find it. It's a riot.
Wow.
It is so flipping funny.
That's crazy.
Wow.
Yeah, because I've talked about that a couple times, and somebody's actually pulled found the video, and it was not a released clip at all. I don't know how they got it, but it's on the internet.
Wow.
You guys should look it up. It's pretty funny.
Okay, we will. Sure.
That's just fantastic.
Yeah.
So, just in closing here, Mario, as far as memories go of you playing with Huey, is there a performance that stands out in your mind that was just something to remember? I mean, you've done so many of them. Is there those one or two performances that stand out in your mind as, hey, this is something special?
Well, yeah, I think. From what I've seen, and you know, you're always kind of wondering, you know, if you get a chance, if you have a chance to review something on video, you'll do it, and you sometimes you're not right, you know. Sometimes you think you had a great night, you hear the video or see a video and say, ugh, we suck. but it's happened many times. But the nights when that I thought we were really good, and that it turned out that the video agreed with me, were us at the Kabuki in San Francisco early on. It was about probably 82 or 83, but it was shot well. The video quality is good, and it was a good, really good performance. It showed us at our best, and then later on, we did a benefit concert at Slim's in San Francisco. I think it was around 1991, and we were on it. It was just a good night, you know. Oh. It was a good night. I remember it well, and so those two shows, I think. I mean, there were bigger shows. Certainly, we played the Tokyo Dome, which is 83,000 seats indoors.
Whoa.
And we sold out three nights at that place. And that was, which is a major event, you know.
Yeah.
But and then, you know, we sold out. We still hold the attendance record at a number of places. One of them is Pine Knob in Detroit. So there were bigger gigs. But as far as just playing one that you knew the band was on, and the videos agree with me, those two shows I think are pretty good.
Awesome.
Yeah. That's wonderful.
Awesome.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what's the future for Mario now? What, you know, where do you see Mario doing now?
Mario's retired. Mario's back gave out. I had a couple surgeries, and then I needed another surgery. I went for a consult with my surgeon, and he announced to me that I had osteoporosis so badly that he had nothing to screw into.
Oh, no.
And he couldn't do any more work on me. He said, I can't do it. Your bones are shot. So that was it. And that was the day I had to quit. So I have actually cut a couple albums since then. In the privacy of my own home, I've done a couple of albums. I have the people will send me tracks, and then I'll take the tracks and put them in Pro Tools, bring them up in the studio, and then cut bass to them, and then I'll just email them the bass part.
Wow!
And they fly it in, and it's done. So I've cut a couple records that way, but. I can't play standing up. I can't do it. I can barely stand up without a bass, let alone with a bass.
Wow.
Bless your heart. Wow.
So that's pretty much it for me.
Will you keep teaching maybe or not?
No.
No.
No, I don't teach. No, no.
Okay.
It's too hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
Teaching is really hard. It shouldn't be, but I'm like with everything with music, I take it probably too seriously, and I always put way too much into each lesson, and it's just kind of a burnout for me. Emily was actually my last student I've ever had.
Wow.
What I do now is I make sure my wife knows how much she's loved. That's my job now.
Oh, that fantastic. Just made my heart swell. His wife's name is Kendra, right?
Kendra.
And she's an RN. Yeah.
No, that's right.
We go out every night. We go out every night on our scooter. We have these electric scooters, these hot rod scooters that go 50 miles an hour. And we go out every night about anywhere between 10 and 2 in the morning. But sometime in there. And we take off on one of our epic journeys, and we go out for usually an hour to 3 hours. And we usually ride for about 15 or 20 miles and come home and hit the sack. But it's our favorite thing to do. We can do it together. And for some reason, I can stand up. I can get my heel on the back of my fender and kind of get my spine kind of crooked, but I can get comfortable.
Wow.
So I figured out a way that I could ride and be comfortable, and that's her favorite thing to do. So I make sure I don't miss a ride. You know, we always go out and pretty much every night start off at the graveyard and take it from there.
That is so neat.
I love that.
Yeah,
I love
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Oh,
thanks for asking.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I can't tell you how much I appreciate. I feel like I've known you forever. It's the weirdest thing.
I know.
It's like, I'm like, he's just must be a brother from another mother or something. I don't know. But
right.
I'm
glad you asked me. I'm glad you asked me to do it. And I'm glad you were patient with me. I screwed up a couple of these, so I apologize for that.
Oh, no worries.
I'm not the most consistent guy I know, I will say.
No, you've been honest and so great to talk to, really. Thank you.
Great talking to you, too, and we'll talk other than this. When we're done, shoot me your email address, and I'll send you that. Little kindness.
Okay.
Wonderful. Great. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Mario, thank you so much. Such a pleasure to visit with you.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
You guys have a fun scooter ride tonight.
Okay, thank you. We will.
Okay, see you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Wow, that was so cool.
That was so cool. He was so honest.
And genuine.
Yes.
And from someone that's had so many years in the music industry.
Yeah.
He was the bass player for Journey. I never knew that.
I didn't know that either.
No idea.
Yeah.
Biggest band ever.
Yeah. Yeah. In the 80s, yeah.
But
for sure.
But he's like, no, I'm going to go play for Huey.
Yeah. Yeah.
Crazy.
That was awesome.
So neat. I can't even imagine the things that guy's seen.
Yeah. And now to be in so much pain. He's a tall guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, they made him the bad guy. So in all the pictures you see him on the albums, he's the guy in the black with the black glasses and a cigarette and just, you know, but he's not. He's like super sweet.
I forgot to ask him about how all of the Back to the Future stuff played into what they did. I wanted to hear his take.
Why don't
on
we
that,
maybe, we should
we'll
do
have to
another.
Do it again.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Let's do another podcast again with
Fantastic.
Him. Awesome.
Well, what a neat podcast. That's the longest one we've ever done.
It is. And we're sorry about the swearing, but it's real.
But it's awesome.
Yep.
We love it.
It is what we love it.
We love it. We flippin' love it. So, again, we want to thank our sponsors, Star Valley Health.
We do.
Here in Afton.
Yep.
Great bunch of people. Go see them.
Yep.
They're here to help. They're great people. Wonderful doctors.
Wonderful doctors.
So go see them. And also, again, thank you to the Pop Shop.
Thank
for
you.
For all that they do for us and for the community. And that's it. So we'll sign off. This is the Why Your Story podcast brought to you by SVI Media. I'm your host, Travis Osmond.
And I'm your host, Mary Jo Parker. Have a wonderful night.
Take care. Be safe.
Bye.